Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with information emerging that the $175 million bond put up by Don Hankey Jr., the bottom-feeding billionaire who so far has lined Trump's pockets with $400 million, may have been the result of Trump's lawyers misleading the New York Appeals Court. Joining us to discuss the ethical duty to present correct information to the court is Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles. She has written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Then, with Trump's plant in Congress, who outgoing conservative Republican Congressman Ken Buck refers to as Moscow Marjorie, threatening Speaker Johnson to withhold aid from Ukraine, we'll examine how adversaries like China and Russia have found a gift in Trump, who divides and weakens America, encouraging secession while threatening civil war. Joining us is Miles Taylor, a national security expert who served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, where he published an anonymous essay in the New York Times blowing the whistle on presidential misconduct. He later published the number one national bestseller, A Warning, revealed himself to be the author, and launched a campaign of ex-officials to oppose Donald Trump's re-election. He worked as an advisor in the George W. Bush administration on Capitol Hill, as a CNN contributor, and is the co-founder of multiple democracy reform groups. His latest book is Blowback, A Warning to Save Democracy from Trump's Revenge, out today in a new version. Then finally, we'll examine how billionaires who don't pay taxes use their surplus money to buy think tanks and politicians who cut their taxes even further, and speak with Michael Gratz, Professor Emeritus at Columbia Law School and Yale Law School. He is a leading authority on tax politics and policy and served as Special Counsel and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy in the United States Department of the Treasury, and is the author and co-author of many books, including Death by a Thousand Cuts, The Fight Over Taxing Inherited Wealth, and The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. His latest book is The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Laurie Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles and has written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Levinson.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a lot more information is coming out about the billionaire out here in Los Angeles who has come to the rescue of Donald Trump with the $175 million for the bond after Trump had failed, or at least his lawyers said they tried 30 other bonding companies in New York to cover the $454 million that was initially asked for by the courts. So more is emerging about this man and extraordinary amount of money he's been giving to Trump, or donating, or dealing, you know, funneling it through business deals that don't appear to make a lot of sense. He had a bank called the Internet Bank that changed its name to Axos. They gave Trump $225 million. And then the D.C. hotel that he had lost $70 million, but then Axos Bank came up with $190 million. In the sale. So that's a total of about $400 million that Don Hankey Jr. so far has funneled to Trump, and he's also funneled money to Jared Kushner as well. So, what's your sense then of Laurie, of the extent to which the New York Appeals Court may have been lied to, or the Trump's lawyers misrepresented the situation, not being able to get a bond, when in fact Don Hankey Jr. has told Politico that he told them he had the money and he was ready to give the whole $454 million.
It certainly raises some very important questions. I mean, it would obviously not be appropriate to bamboozle the appellate court by giving them false information. I suspect that Trump's lawyers are going to say, well, this information is new to us. And when we made the application, we in good faith didn't think we could get the higher amount. And in any case, that the court put an excessive amount on the bond, so everything's fine in the wash. But I don't think that really answers it. Because in when there are dealings like this behind the scenes, that's okay if it doesn't involve the court. It's not okay if there are continuing misrepresentations to the court.
So the LA Times have done a pretty deep dive investigating Don Hankey Jr. and his business practices. He's in the subprime car loan business. This Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has gone after him for charging 268% interest rates, which is the kind of usury that would make the mafia blush. He's also been sued by the Department of Justice for repossessing cars from US soldiers. So, is there any sense anywhere, Laurie, why he's loaning so much money to Trump and what he gets out of it? He did say, apparently, in his interview with Politico, that when he offered to pay the full $454 million, he said to Trump's lawyers that he'd be happy to take real estate as collateral. So, do we have any idea of what kind of payoff Hankey gets for his generosity towards Trump?
Well, what we know is that there's the business dealing, but there's also the access. And it's probably not just a question of what he will get paid as his fee for providing the money for this bond. As you noted, there are ongoing relationships, and so he will be within the Trump sphere. And frankly, I think he's thinking Trump owes me. What that leads to, we don't know. And he's played it fairly close to the vest, even what his deal is with regard to the bond. He has said it's modest, but what does that mean when you're in the hundreds of millions of dollars? So in this situation, all we know is that somebody who had the money is somebody who is approaching Trump and had prior relationships. Where that leads, we really don't know.
So Letitia James has gotten the judge to hold a hearing on April the 22nd to look into what we're talking about now. What would you anticipate goes on at that hearing, and what kind of ruling could Judge Ngoron come up with to pull Trump and his lawyers over?
From the court's perspective, the main focus is going to be, is this for real? I mean, if Trump does default, if he doesn't pay up on this judgment, will the court really get its money? Is this all just sort of paper money, on paper, I mean by that? Or is there really money behind this? I think from Letitia James' perspective, she does want to explore whether there were misrepresentations to the court. Because that puts the lawyers in the hot seat, frankly, not just in this case, but in other cases as well. Because a lawyer has an ethical responsibility to tell the truth every time they represent something to the court. And if they find out that someone led them to do a misrepresentation, they're supposed to fix it. So I think Letitia James wants to explore the business, the ongoing relationship, and who knew what.
Well, there's so much suspicion about the qualifications of John Hankey Jr. His company is not even registered in New York State, right?
That's her primary pitch, in fact, that she came in and said, this is of concern. There's reasons for registration. There's reasons to make sure that you have individuals who are complying the local rules, even if they don't like or think that they're important. And I think from her perspective, part of the overall problem with the Trump case is that people don't want to play by the rules.
But the bottom line, surely, is that the judgment of the court, he's been tried and convicted, has he not, for civil fraud?
He's been found liable on the civil fraud,
Right.
yes.
Right. And he still has to pay at the end of the day, does he not? What's about
If
Florida?
he loses his appeal, he has to pay. And that's why he has to put up a bond, so that there will be money to be there if, in fact, he loses the appeal. If he wins the appeal, then he'll get most of that money back, except for what the fee is. So the big question is going to be when that will be decided. But in the meantime, he has to be on the hook for at least a portion of it. Otherwise, there's no reason for him to ignore the court judgment.
And do you think the courts are now suspicious about whether this even this 175 million is properly secured?
I think so. I think that's what Letitia James is raising with the court, that Trump and his organization already got an enormous break by dropping the amount of the bond from 450 million to 175 million or the like. If you're going to do that, you have to definitely make sure that the court trusts you. And recent events really raise the question.
So, in general, is there a possibility that not just in this case, where it may well be that Trump's lawyers misled the New York Appeals Court, but the fact that he's now trying to delay the hush money trial that's supposed to start on Monday with what seems like a frivolous lawsuit, isn't there such a thing as Rule 11? I mean, how long can Trump get away with his obvious tactic of delay, delay, delay?
Well, for your listeners, Rule 11 is a rule that says there have to be a good faith basis for bringing actions in court. And what that relates to just is your credibility. So if you want to focus on one of the biggest problems Donald Trump has had and will have ongoing in his cases, is that people don't necessarily trust him. They don't trust his word. They don't trust his financial dealings. Don't forget, he just, opened his own social media platform. All of that is affected by Trump and whether there's the trust for him.
So, this seems to be, in the broadest sense, though, Laurie Levinson, what seems to be at stake here is if this character, Donald Trump, who seems to be a serial scofflaw, schooled by none other than Roy Cohn, do you think at the end of the day this is affecting the general public and the standing of law in this country? I mean, law, doesn't the law operate on the basis of a consensus that the public believes in the law? And if you undermine the law in a kind of serial way, then doesn't that invite other people to do the same, and the entire edifice of the legal structure is undermined?
Well, currently we're having a major conversation about whether Trump or anybody is above the law. Don't forget that he is somebody who has raised the issue, and the Supreme Court's going to decide it of whether he has absolute immunity. Now, these actions regarding the posting of the bond, they're not necessarily criminal, but people put it into their own vernacular. Does somebody with the power or the money, the connections of a Trump, have to play by the same rules? From the court and judge's perspective, I think they're really frustrated because this is not something we regularly see. We don't see the type of antics in or out of the courtroom. From the public's perspective, I don't know how people are seeing it. And that's why it's unclear whether this will change in terms of the elections, any of the range of support for Trump.
But the Supreme Court, what do you think? Are they fed up? I mean, the fact that they're entertaining this case, which seems specious to begin with, his claim of presidential immunity, even after he's left the presidency. Just yesterday, a group of very senior U.S. military officers sent a brief via a special counsel, Jack Smith, basically arguing that you cannot do this. You cannot give a president immunity because we in the military would then be faced with the possibility of having to obey an illegal order.
Right. I read that brief, the friend of the court brief filed by military. There have been other briefs as well, but I think that one has a lot of impact, which is how much respect for the law plays in all of our institutions. So telling somebody that they have carte blanche, even if they have the title of president, is not necessarily what we want for our country. In fact, it's the exact opposite. What we've always had pride in is that America is different, that we are a country built upon laws. If you tell somebody you have immunity, it doesn't apply to you, that whole basic ethos is out the door. Trump is arguing one cannot do their job as president if they're worried that people will hunt them down and prosecute them. I think there were very good responses in the brief that this hasn't happened. And what we want are people who can do the job and still follow the law.
But doesn't the Supreme Court require four votes to just to take on a case, which would indicate that four of the justices are even entertaining the possibility that Trump's claim of immunity has some validity?
Well, I think there are four justices who have found this to be a really significant issue. It might be one of the most important issues that our court decides now, and they've been deciding a lot of important issues. Not necessarily that they agree with Trump. There may be justices who do, but I think that there are justices who say, if this is coming down the pike, we better have a rule so that people do know how our institutions are going to work. We won't know until we hear the argument. But it's going to be very significant how much deference the Supreme Court's going to give to the executive branch.
So, just in closing, then, Lauren Levinson, just to go through the four major court cases facing Trump with 91 indictments, it seems that the most easy one to prove would be the classified documents case down in Florida. And that judge seems to be delaying and delaying and helping Trump as much as she can. And at this point, it seems that the special counsel might want to pull the trigger and try and have the 11th Circuit remove her. I'm interested in your opinion on where that stands. Obviously, the Washington, D.C. case of January the 6th, that is being held up. And also the case in Atlanta, the prosecutor herself has been sort of dirtied up a little, and that case is apparently not likely to happen in any case before the election's over. So, what would your quick thumbnail sketch of where these cases stand in terms of whether or not the public will get a full picture of Trump's activities before they vote for him one way or the other, or vote for or against him?
Well, I think your assessment is correct in terms of the Mar-a-Lago case. That probably is one of the more straightforward cases for the prosecutor, but Judge Cannon has stalled it. And some of her rulings just seem almost bizarre. So Jack Smith is saying that he wants to take it to the appellate court. I don't know that she would be removed. He just feels that somebody needs to guide her on the law. I think the Georgia case is also stalled because of Fani Willis and Nathan Wade and the conflict of interest. So I don't know that we're going to hear that case before the election. Then we go to the Washington, D.C. case, which is waiting for a Supreme Court ruling. Is it possible that that January 6th case could happen? It is, but it will be a push to get it in by the end of the summer. So the main focus, ironically, is on this hush money case. We're going to have people like Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen testifying. It's not exactly the case, I think, that gives an overview of the concerns about Trump, but it's the one that the New York courts are going to have go.
Well, Laura Levinson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Levinson, who holds the David W. Burcham Chair in Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles and has written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining how adversaries like China and Russia have found a gift in Trump, who divides and weakens America, encouraging secession while threatening civil war.
What about the war in destitute?
Destitute, where they don't matter, they do not.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Miles Taylor, a national security expert who served as the chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, where he published an anonymous essay in the New York Times blowing the whistle on presidential misconduct. He later published the number one bestseller, A Warning, revealed himself to be the author, and launched a campaign of ex-officials to oppose Donald Trump's re-election. He worked as an advisor in the George W. Bush administration on Capitol Hill and as a CNN contributor, and is the co-founder of multiple democracy reform groups. And his latest book is Blowback, A Warning to Save Democracy from Trump's Revenge, out today in a new version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miles Taylor.
Ian, great to be with you as always.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we are, I think, heading for some kind of, people talk about a civil war, but essentially, if Trump wins the election, gets reelected in November, then he's already said, him and the Heritage Foundation and others have already laid out their plans for massive concentration of camps, arresting and imprisoning critics, journalists, etc. That would have the effect of bringing a lot of protesters out on the streets. And then, of course, this possibility of martial law, one doesn't know exactly how the military would handle it. But Trump has his other Trump card up his sleeve, which is the militias. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is if he loses in November, he won't accept the defeat as he did in 2020. So do you think some kind of civil war is inevitable, or how would you put it on the scale of a warning?
Well, I like to rate things on a spectrum, Ian, of mild to wild. And I think right now, as a country, we're on the wild side of the spectrum. And what you just laid out, I think, is the dilemma that we're facing this year, which is that folks don't have the luxury of saying, hey, you know, it might not be that bad. We may dodge, an ugly scenario. That's not the case. Pretty much whatever the outcome is, whatever scenario ends up happening at the end of the year, there's a very high chance of being thrust into constitutional crisis. So that's what we're facing at the moment, is the reality that either outcome is potentially very disastrous for the country. So what can people do about it? Well, look, in the immediate, I think one of the most important things is that we focus on reinforcing the guardrails of our democracy. Now, there's probably not a high likelihood of us seeing congressional legislation passed in a way that would fortify institutional guardrails. But there, you know, just this past week, there was a group of constitutional scholars, lawyers, and others who warned about the vagaries of the Insurrection Act that would allow some pretty dangerous things to be done with the weaponization of executive power. There is a diminishing window to be able to tighten up that law and avoid its misuse. Now, again, I'm not woolly-eyed about the likelihood of those things happening, but we have opportunities to try to protect our country against the worst in this intervening period. But ultimately, it's going to come down to the people themselves to do the right thing in November. We've got to stop saying that, you know, the courts are going to save us, or the investigators are going to save us, or, you know, some sort of judgment against the ex-president is going to save us. Ultimately, if we want to avoid a very, very tumultuous and potentially destructive second term of Donald Trump, we need to do it ourselves. It's going to require people putting country over party, and Republicans teaming up with Democrats to do what they did in 2020, which is deny the man another opportunity to be in office. That's what it's got to come down to. And that means everyday Americans have got to be talking to their neighbors, to their friends, to their business associates about why we've got to, again, put country over party when it comes to this election.
And just yesterday, a group of senior U.S. military officers wrote a brief in support of the special counsel in the Supreme Court case hearing Trump's claim of presidential immunity, arguing that you cannot give Trump immunity because these senior officers don't want to be in a position where they have to follow an illegal order. So it's come down to that. And when I say civil war, maybe that's an exaggeration. The head of the former head of the Council on Foreign Relations argued recently in a book that the more likely scenario with Trump and the way he's divided this country, which of course is helping Putin and Xi and other despots around the world, is a more likely scenario would be the troubles in Northern Ireland. Is that something that you think is more possible than some more drastic manifestation of Trump's divisiveness?
Well, I think we do need to be really clear-eyed about it and not afraid to admit how bad it could get, because we need to sort of live in those worst-case scenarios if we want to avoid those worst-case scenarios. And I think it's fitting that this week there is an Alex Garland film premiering called Civil War that, blurs the core reasons behind why the country breaks out into armed conflict, but displays in what I understand to be very vivid fashion what that would look like. I think that's as important a warning as any, that we could end up going down that path if we make the wrong decision. Now, if you would ask me what I think the likeliest outcome is, looking at the medium term of political instability, it's probably what one of my former colleagues called soft secession. A lot of people are familiar with Fiona Hill, a Republican who worked as Donald Trump's advisor on Russia. Fiona and I worked together, and before she was in the White House, she was a noted scholar of international conflict and civil strife. She spent decades looking at foreign conflicts abroad and determining what the correlations were between nation states that ended up going down that wrong path and wound up in civil conflict. And one of the things Fiona found in her studies is that often one of the biggest precursors to democratic decline was what she would call soft secession, is where you have states or localities starting to create different legal structures from one another, culturally separating, yes, but then starting to not respect each other's legal edicts. And, we are seeing that on a range of different policy issues in the United States, where, red areas and blue areas are essentially competing with one another to enforce a certain set of laws and not others. And that slow normalization of the sort of legal separation would fall, I think, in the category of what Fiona would call soft secession. And it's a prelude to something potentially worse. And so we're seeing those indicators right now as a country. I certainly think if Donald Trump wins a second term, we'll see an acceleration of that soft secession. And it heralds potentially, as you say, a Northern Ireland example of low-level political violence. But as we all know, low-level political violence can spiral into something much worse. And that's really what we need to avoid. And the lights are blinking red, regardless of your politics. The data is very clear. This is the highest level of political threats and intimidation we've seen in the modern age, highest level of threats to public servants we've seen, and the greatest level of chatter about potential domestic terrorism threats since 9/11. That is extraordinary, and we can't lose sight of it.
Well, when you talk about secession, Miles Taylor, the state media in China, and in particular in Russia, are playing up what they call Texit, the exit of Texas, like Brexit, because of Governor Abbott's secessionist moves on the border, defying federal authority, etc. So our enemies, if you will, are already pushing this narrative. And it gets back to the observation that Trump is the gift that keeps on giving, as far as Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping are concerned. And that's where your firsthand experience of having witnessed him in the Oval Office in his first term, it seems, without getting into amateur psychiatrics, that the real issue about Trump is that he's a weak strongman, and he's terrified of the world finding out about what a fraud he is, and how pathetic and stupid and ignorant and reckless he is. And that's what you and the others, like General Kelly and others, witnessed firsthand. So the fact that he's attacked you so viciously would indicate to me that he's terrified of people like you and people like the generals, Mattis and Kelly and others, So what can be done to get that word out, to get under his skin? Because it's pretty clear to me that this is the thing that he's most afraid of, that people will find out what a fraud he is.
Well, Ian, I want to zoom in on the first point that you made about foreign adversaries, because I think a lot of folks don't realize, as they get tied up in the political controversies of the day, that a lot of these controversies have either been manufactured by foreign adversary countries, Russia or China, or at a minimum, magnified by them. And that sounds very conspiratorial, but we have the data to back it up. We have Xi Jinping in Beijing and Vladimir Putin in Russia ordering their lieutenants to try to inflame social divisions in the United States as a way of dividing and weakening the American Republic. And this has been a multi-year endeavor. And we saw how incredibly successful it was in 2016. Now, what worries me is we've seen a remarkable leap technologically that allows them to do this at far greater scale than they were able to before. And let me give you an example. In 2016, when Russia operationalized something called the Internet Research Agency, it had hundreds of keyboard warriors, cyber hackers who were trying to sow discord in the United States by creating divisive memes and groups of Americans pitted against each other on social media. But it took a lot of work. That was very hard for them to do. They spent millions of dollars, tons of money, tons of personnel. The things the Russians did in 2016, I could do with a tiny group of people today with AI-powered tools, AI agents, and online interactive bots and technologies. It doesn't take a 500-person internet research agency to pull off that level of election interference. It can be done at extraordinary scale technologically now, in a way that just wasn't possible in 2016. We have not experienced the full force of that sort of nefarious activity this election cycle. It's something that I'm very worried about, and we know, if passed as prologue, that we're likely to see those regimes try to put their thumb on the scales for Donald Trump, because they see his presidency as more beneficial to them than a second term of Joe Biden. That's something to look out for. And in fact, the US intelligence community has already said they are seeing indicators of that interference from those nation states and others. And I don't think that's getting nearly enough attention. But then, as you know, Ian, what can we do about the potential return of Donald Trump to the White House? I think the most effective answer is to get those voices of people who served around him and for him out there as a cohort to speak candidly about what he wanted to do in a first Donald Trump term that he was prevented from doing, and what he would do without those guardrails around him. And that may sound like, that may sound old hat, because we've heard that so many times. But as you and I have talked about, it worked in 2020. It didn't convince tens of millions of MAGA masses to turn against him. But what it did do is it provided air cover for people who were disaffected Republicans like me, who were frustrated with Donald Trump, to choose another path, showing that there was a tribe of the tribeless, if you will, Republicans who were fed up with this sort of unusual direction of the GOP under Donald Trump. And that needs to happen again. And there was a historic number of people, as you noted in the intro, who left his administration and went and revealed some of the more alarming plans that he had for a first term. We need to get those voices out there in concerted fashion, to tell the story again of how badly this could go. And I think that that's important more than anyone, for Republicans of conscience to hear.
So, just in terms of Russians in particular, along with Chinese efforts to sow divisions, and we're unfortunately obliging them because we are tribal and divided, and social media inflames these divisions. It's interesting to note that just in the last couple of days, two senior Republican House members, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Turner, and the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Michael McCaul, both warned that Republicans are parroting Russian propaganda, and it's even happening on the floor of the House. And now we have very conservative Republican Congressman Ken Buck, who's quit in protest, referring to Marjorie Taylor Greene as Moscow Marjorie. She, of course, is now today, on now that the House is back, is threatening to double down on getting rid of Mike Johnson over Ukraine aid. And it's hard not to make that connection when her fellow Republicans are referring to us as Moscow Marjorie. How much do you think there is a pro-Putin caucus, both in the House and the Senate?
I think it's been remarkably successful. If you were sitting in the Kremlin right now, I think you would hear laughter and applause for how effective that campaign has been. And I urge Republicans to take Mike Turner and Michael McCaul very, very seriously. These are two longtime Republican members of Congress who are privy to the most sensitive intelligence on this threat. And they are warning their colleagues that they are getting played. And I think that's important for the voters to hear. I used to work for Michael McCaul. And in fact, during Russia's interference in the 2016 election, I was McCaul's national security advisor. And I was there for the initial briefings that we had on Russian interference in that election. We were extremely alarmed. We tried to sound the alarm, but I don't think people woke up fast enough. And the biggest concern of ours at the time was Donald Trump himself refused to accept the intelligence, refused to condemn Russian interference. And at the time, it had us scratching our heads, like, why on earth will he not condemn a foreign country interfering in our elections? And I think the answer later became obvious, because he welcomed any interference that supported his candidacy. Now we're in a far deeper mess than we were in 2016, because in 2016, it was just Donald Trump we were worried about ignoring the intelligence. Now we've got the entirety, it seems, or a plurality of the Republican caucus ignoring this glaring information. It's not partisan information. It's not something political ginned up by the American intelligence community. It's things that our spies are risking their lives to go collect. And that is information showing that our adversaries are playing us, and they're trying to get Republican members of Congress to do their bidding. The fact that it's working should alarm every American, regardless of their political affiliation. And so again, I would say Mike Turner and Michael McCaul are canaries in the coal mine here, but they've got a much tougher task in 2024 than they did 8 years ago, as a lot of the members of Congress around them simply refuse to believe it.
But just in closing, Trump has gone further in terms of his praise for Putin and whatever the connections are, which are very murky, but obviously very real. He recently said he encouraged Russia to do whatever the hell they liked with any NATO member that didn't pay up. And he also praised Putin as a genius for invading Ukraine. So I don't know how much more evidence we need about whose side Trump's on.
I don't know how much evidence most people need either, Ian, because I would think I've seen as much of it as you could possibly see. But, you know, what this reminds me of is there was a famous film in the 1980s that folks remember called Red Dawn. And in the movie Red Dawn, you end up having Soviet forces parachuting into the United States. You have this invasion of the U.S. homeland. What we're experiencing right now is a Red Dawn without the parachutes. We, without even having to forcibly invade the United States, we are seeing Kremlin propaganda being parroted by U.S. citizens themselves, and not just U.S. citizens, U.S. leaders. This is, as we say, way too much. This is a five-alarm fire, and it's meant to meddle in our politics. It's meant to warp our worldview, but ultimately, it's meant to break the Western alliance. Our adversaries, we should read something into the fact that they're hoping for a second Donald Trump term. Why? Because they know he wants to pull back from NATO. They know he wants to pull back from the what's called the Washington Consensus after World War II, the whole backbone that defines free trade and free people and remake the Western liberal world order in a way that puts its finger on the scales in favor of autocratic regimes instead of free ones. That is a total remaking of the world that we live in. And it's not an overstatement to say that the Western world order is on a precipice and certainly will fall off of it if Donald Trump wins a second term. That's what we're up against. Those are the stakes.
Well, Miles Taylor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Miles Taylor, who's a national security expert who served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, where he published an anonymous essay in the New York Times blowing the whistle on presidential misconduct. He later published the number one national bestseller, A Warning, revealed himself to be the author, and launched a campaign of ex-officials to oppose Donald Trump's re-election. He worked as an advisor in the George W. Bush administration on Capitol Hill and as a CNN contributor, and is the co-founder of multiple democracy reform groups. And his latest book is Blowback, A Warning to Save Democracy from Trump's Revenge, out today in a new version. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into how billionaires who don't pay taxes use their surplus money to buy think tanks and politicians who cut their taxes even further.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Gratz, who's a professor emeritus at Columbia Law School and Yale Law School, and a leading authority on tax politics and policy. He served as special counsel and deputy assistant secretary for tax policy at the United States Department of the Treasury, and is the author and co-author of many books, including Death by a Thousand Cuts, The Fight Over Taxing Inherited Wealth, and The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. And his latest book is The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Gratz.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael. And it's recently Trump hosted a bunch of billionaires down at Mar-a-Lago, and many of them were appalled by what happened on January the 6th and cut ties to Trump. But they've all come back into the fold for the simple reason that Trump, if he's reelected in November, will basically, he may not just keep the tax cuts for the super rich in place, but he may actually give them even more tax breaks. And if Biden comes in, the Trump's tax cuts law sunsets in 2025 and Biden would not renew it. So is it that naked and that simple that we just have a sort of plutocracy that just simply is greedy and doesn't really want to participate in, as the rest of us do, in paying our fair share of taxes?
Well, it's pretty clear that the billionaires don't want to pay any more taxes than they are now, and Biden would like them to do so. Although, Ian, I want to mention that Biden made proposals in 2022 that would have taxed the wealthy, similar to the proposals that he's made in the current budget. And none of those proposals passed in a Democratic Congress. So I think these billionaires have less to fear from the Congress than they might believe. And if this is the reason they're moving to Trump, they may not need to move to Trump in order to at least stay where they are.
But what it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, it seems that the billionaires, like, for example, Jeff Yass, who is the biggest donor to the Republican Party, and he recently met with Trump down in Mar-a-Lago, he has a 15% stake in TikTok, which is worth about $30 billion. And Trump was trashing TikTok until he met with Jeff Yass, and now he's singing TikTok's praises. But Jeff Yass, his entire focus in life seems to be on avoiding paying taxes. And he's a huge donor to Grover Norquist's nonprofit. And Grover Norquist, of course, is famous for saying he wants to shrink the government down to the size where it can be drowned in a bathtub. And Grover Norquist gets money from other plutocratic and powerful industrialists, etc. So I guess the theory that I have, which seems pretty obvious, that I may be wrong, that is that billionaires who don't pay their taxes and find ways to avoid paying taxes through the wealth protection industry of lawyers and accountants, the surplus money that they have, they invest in politics and in people like Grover Norquist, who make them even richer. Is that a cycle that's going on here?
Well, I think it is a cycle that's going on here. There's a lot of evidence that the legislation coming out of Congress protects the high income and wealthy people and not the average American. But it's both sides that are looking for money. And while Grover Norquist is no doubt the most famous of the wealth protection crowd, since he insists that even if you close loopholes, you have to cut taxes somewhere else. So you can't even close a loophole without some tax cut, in Grover's mind. There are plenty of other wealth protection legislators in the U.S. Congress and in state houses around the country, I think. And so it spreads beyond just Norquist and Donald Trump, but it's certainly, they're certainly safe with Grover and Trump, that taxes won't go up on them. Trump himself is famous for not wanting to pay taxes, and so he's very sympathetic to others who have that view.
So, Michael, are you suggesting then that the real problem is Citizens United, is the fact that we have a money-driven political system, and he who has the most money wins in American politics?
I think the Supreme Court's view, which actually goes back before Citizens United into the 1970s, a case called Buckley v. Vallejo, that money and spending money is the equivalent of free speech and is somehow protected by the Constitution, is the root of this problem, and the demise of the public financing of political campaigns, including the presidency, which actually began with Barack Obama's rejection of public financing, but has been inadequate for the current campaigns for a long time, definitely has tilted the playing field against middle America. There's no question about that.
So, Michael, let's talk about your new book, The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. And it takes us back to 1978 when California enacted Proposition 13, a cap on property taxes that Ronald Reagan hailed as the second American revolution. And of course, Jarvis, who brought it about, was a landlord in California. And it's resulted in the decimation of public education, because public education in the state of California was in part financed by property taxes and by essentially allowing people who owned properties, and that included homes, but also apartment buildings and various commercial properties, basically have saved $30 billion in 2018 thanks to Proposition 13, and industrial owners have saved $11 billion, and meanwhile, education has been underfunded. So the people that grandfathered it in, they pay virtually 1% taxes, property taxes, but the house next door, who's a new house, pays 30 times as much. So it's a very unfair system, and it's had a detrimental effect on education. But it seems to be that's where it all started. And then at around that time, these libertarian economists like Milton Friedman and Arthur Laffer emerged, coming up with this incredibly insane idea that you could cut taxes by 30% over 3 years, and suddenly government revenues would miraculously increase, because the lower taxes would incentivize investment and economic growth, which of course was a fantasy. And instead, what happened was Reagan ran up the deficit enormously, increasing defense spending. And of course, when the debt becomes a major part of the budget, that in effect also helps the plutocracy, because they own the debt and the poor taxpayer services the debt. So is that where it all began and has gotten progressively worse since?
Well, it did all begin, I think, with Proposition 13 in California. And as you suggest, Howard Jarvis was an unlikely person to find his face on the cover of Time magazine under the heading Tax Revolt. But that was where the tax revolt started, and it had exactly the effect that you described in California, which is that it created huge inequities depending on when your parent or grandparent now bought the property that you're living in, or when someone bought the property. The people who've been around for a long time pay much less in taxes than those who don't. And in 2020, the people of California voted not to change it even for commercial businesses. So businesses that have been there for a long time have great benefits, and the new innovative businesses are paying more in property taxes. And so it's a completely unfair system that has had a major impact on the spending of the government in California, particularly, as you say, on education. And where we are now is that we've got a huge amount of federal debt, more than we've had since the end of World War II. At the end of World War II, we were poised to grow in a way that would benefit all Americans for decades until about the mid-70s. And now the interest on the federal debt is greater than the entire growth of the U.S. economy. And 35 cents or so of every dollar that we pay in interest costs goes abroad, some of which doesn't go to our friends. And this is going to get worse because the debt just continues to accumulate. And as you say, it really started with Ronald Reagan, whose combination of tax cuts and defense spending basically tripled the national debt. It went from $900 billion to $2.7 trillion. He accumulated twice as much debt during his presidency as all of the presidents that preceded him. And then in the 21st century, for lots of reasons, including large tax cuts in the Bush administration and in the Trump administration, along with the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the financial crisis, paying for the COVID pandemic and keeping the economy running, we're in much worse shape than we've ever been in terms of the government's finances.
But Michael, you mentioned that there was another chance for the people in California to get rid of Proposition 13 back in 2020, and they didn't, which would indicate that they'd have drunk the Kool-Aid, which is what Reagan and his kitchen cabinet of billionaires have managed to hoist, and it's done well. I mean, prior to Reagan, we had a savings-based economy, and Reagan turned that around to a credit-based economy just to maintain the illusion that you're keeping ahead when most Americans don't have any savings and they're $400 away from penury. But this is very clever marketing that they done. They duped Americans into giving the rich tax breaks for both the billionaires and for corporations. And because of these tax cuts, ordinary Americans are subsidizing big corporations and dynastic billionaire families at the expense of getting fewer and fewer government services. So when are they going to wake up?
Well, I wish I had an answer to that question. They've been enormously successful. The Trump tax cuts, many of them, $3.5 trillion of tax cuts, expire at the end of 2025. Given the country's financial situation, you'd say, well, there's no way they can be extended. But given the politics of the anti-tax movement, which has been enormously successful, they almost certainly will all be extended. There may be a few offsets if there are Democrats in the Congress, controlling the Congress or in the White House. But even the Democrats don't want to tax anybody below $400,000. So a lot of this will get extended no matter who's in charge. And as we talked about earlier, taxing the billionaires, which is where Joe Biden would like to pay for these tax cuts is not likely to happen because of the great prominence of money in the American political system. And if you're against taxes, finding resources to go to Congress and try and convince them that this is a good idea is very easy. It's not hard, as you say, to find a billionaire here or there that's willing to finance this anti-tax movement. And unlike, I mean, just worth mentioning, Ian, that unlike the women's movement or the civil rights movement, the anti-tax movement has not suffered any setbacks in this century. And I suspect that they will not suffer a setback in 2025, even though the time has certainly come for a setback.
Well, just in closing then, you don't think there's any way the American public can be educated about how social democracy works and how people in other countries, the Scandinavian countries, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada next door, in many ways have a much better deal. They certainly have better government services. And, you know, it's a simple formula. You pay your taxes and you get government services, and it makes everybody, you know, more conscious of who represents you as the stewards of your tax money. But there's a complete detachment in America between the citizen and their representatives as far as what happens to the money. It doesn't.
No, that's exactly right. And the borrowing is an invisible form of tax. You know, the fact that we now have interest, which is growing faster than Medicare expenditures or Medicaid or national defense. It's the fastest growing expenditure of the federal government, with the exception of Social Security. It's invisible, and so we're paying taxes. We're sending all this money abroad, we're paying interest, and we're sending all this money abroad, and we don't realize it. And so we're a very low tax country compared to the rest of the world. Only Ireland in Europe is less, and the other countries are in Latin America and South America, not countries we like to compare ourselves to.
Right.
But it's very hard to know how this anti-tax movement will be headed off, and it's also very much an anti-IRS movement, as you know, from the Republican anti-tax and anti-IRS efforts.
Well, Michael Gratz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Gratz, who's Professor Emeritus at Columbia Law School and Yale Law School and leading authority on tax politics and policy. He served as Special Counsel and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy in the United States Department of the Treasury, and is the author and co-author of many books, including Death by a Thousand Cuts, The Fight Over Taxing Inherited Wealth, and The Burger Court and the Rise of the Judicial Right. And his latest book just out is The Power to Destroy: How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.